This is the Vermont Edition podcast. You know what makes a great podcast? Editing. This episode is shorter than the version you heard on air. Enjoy.
Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, many issues are in play at the State House as lawmakers shoot for a weekend adjournment, but there are some key disagreements on a number of important bills. Governor Phil Scott wants to implement a statewide health care contract for all teachers, but many Democrats want these negotiations to remain at the local level. The governor says he's encouraged by a close vote in the House this week over his plan.
If anybody had wagered the odds of that 2 weeks ago, I don't think they would have come to that conclusion. So my guess is we're building momentum.
Where is all of this heading, and what's happening with other important bills? Today on Vermont Edition, we've got a group of Vermont's best political reporters to help us answer some of these questions. With us today, Terry Hollenbeck of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger. Great to have you all back.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with Governor Scott's health care plan, one of the top outstanding issues at the State House. Because of provisions of the Affordable Care Act, all teacher health care plans are up for renewal this year. The governor wants to have a statewide health care contract for all teachers, one where the state actually negotiates that contract. The governor says this plan could save as much as $26 million a year without adding any financial burden to the teachers.
Now we have a once-in-a-generation, if not a lifetime, opportunity to save up to $26 million per year while maintaining health care coverage for school employees.
But Senate President Tim Ash says this is not the time to make a major change in the way that teachers get their health care.
We are not interested in, literally in the last week of the session, contemplating a departure from decades of the way teachers and school boards negotiate. What we're saying is we all agree we want to realize as much of that up to $26 million in savings as we can.
So, Terry, the governor doesn't like to use the word veto threat, but is he telling lawmakers here at the end of the week that if they don't adopt his plan, perhaps the budget would get vetoed?
Well, I think he is not using veto because he is leaving the door open to it. Doesn't necessarily have to be his exact plan, but something close to it. And I think there's no way that the legislature is going to go for changing the negotiations to the statewide level. It's just not going to happen. But there could be still some common ground on reserving any savings from the teacher health care plans for the making sure that it goes back to the state and in the form of property tax relief. How exactly that happens, whether it happens, still unclear.
April, there was a very close vote on Wednesday night on this issue in the House, and basically House Speaker Mitzi Johnson had to cast a vote to create a tie and therefore defeat the governor's plan. There were a fair number of Democratic defections. Was that a surprise?
It was a surprise to me, and I think Terry talked to a lot of them and could maybe give some details about their reasoning. But yes, I mean, when the proposal for the statewide contract first came out from the governor, we heard a lot around the State House of this is too late, there's no way. And then for there to be a tie vote really showed how the math had changed, and the proposal that was ultimately offered on the floor, I think, won some more people over than the governor's original plan had. There were some tweaks that made it a little bit more amenable to some of the Democrats, but I was surprised to see that vote.
You know, Elizabeth, there were 73 people voting for the governor's plan, so that's certainly more than enough people to sustain a gubernatorial veto. How does that enter into all these negotiations now? I mean, do we have a stalemate where the Democrats, most of the Democrats at the State House, are saying to the governor, well, you know, if you want to veto the budget, go ahead and do it, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks. How do the dynamics work here?
I think we're still seeing that play out. We are, you know, about 36 hours away from adjournment at this point, and we don't have a budget finalized. And so I think that does speak to how much things are in flux at the moment. And certainly we heard from House Republicans that their next plan here is to ask the governor for a veto and to get the pressure that way. So, you know, there still is time for things to shake out. But I think Terry's right also that there is also wiggle room there. You know, we might not necessarily see a veto.
You know, Terry, we haven't seen a lot of big fights between Democratic leaders at the State House and Republican Governor Phil Scott this session. Are they kind of itching for a fight?
I think that's a factor, is that to some extent, I think the Republicans do want to feel their new power and veto the budget if it's even close to needing to be vetoed. I think the governor did take the legislature by surprise of getting traction on this teacher health care issue as much as he did. I mean, it's really $13 million for next year because the health care plans start in January. He keeps using the figure 26 or 25 million. And that is not an absolute gimme that it will be that much. It will be up to that much. It will depend on what plans teachers end up choosing. It'll depend on how much health care they use because it's a self-insured system. It will depend on there's incentives built into the new plan on whether to get you to not use the ER and use urgent care instead, maybe, or get generic drugs. It's all built on a model of do they end up saving money on health care in a way that the governor can't control.
In April, a lot of people are saying, where do these savings come from? Are these lower premiums for the next round of health care policies?
Yes, my understanding is there are lower premiums. There would be about $75 million approximately in premium savings. And the idea is that they would that whoever negotiates, whether it's the local school board or the state, would use about $50 million of that savings to, they say, keep teachers whole through health savings accounts or something like that to try to cover some out-of-pocket costs, and then use the remaining $26 million or whatever it ends up being for tax relief. So that's kind of the math that's behind it. They are lower premium plans. They're a little bit less generous in terms of coverage. And as Terry said, they would start in January.
And Elizabeth, is this a case where the governor feels like if there's one state negotiator going up against the teachers' union, that person can drive a harder bargain than the 240 school boards out there?
My understanding is yes. And I've heard from lawmakers up there who have served on their school boards before about the challenges that they have faced when they've been in this process. And, you know, even just scheduling is very difficult for somebody who doesn't do this professionally. And so I think that that's part of the logic behind it.
We've got a number of listeners who would like to weigh in on this subject. So let's start with John in Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much, Bob. This does not come as a surprise to anybody in Vermont who is faced with high property taxes. This is extremely understandable. It's also extremely understandable that the money saved is because teachers have been getting Cadillac plans and they're now going to platinum plans. Most people in Vermont do not have platinum plans but are paying for these things. There is a win-win solution here, and that would require some compromise, but it would be to go to a statewide negotiation and take any savings that we do have and put it in the underfunded teachers' retirement fund. The Senate passed their budget, had property tax increases to help pay for the underfunded teachers' retirement fund. What we need to do, and this would not be how much dependent, but whatever was saved, give it back to the teachers in ensuring the solvency of the retirement fund, which right now is a drag on the budget now and in the future unless we address it.
So, John, you would use that money for something other than property tax relief?
It would be, in fact, property tax relief because the Senate's budget has property taxes going up to fund the teachers' retirement fund. This is an obligation that the legislature has neglected for years, and it affects our credit rating if we don't fund it. You know, people are tapped out in Vermont, and that this would be a way. It's a compromise. It would be a way of taking the savings and putting it directly to something that benefits the teachers as well, the solvency of that fund. At the same time, Vermont, we have a tremendous amount of needs, and we're tapped out on property taxes and fees. Mm-hmm. And that's why Phil Scott got elected, and that's why his proposal has so much strength, even among many Democrats.
Okay, John, we really appreciate your phone call. Terry, we've been talking about the governor's plan for a statewide health care contract for teachers, but to make it even more complicated, as John mentioned, the Senate did transfer responsibility for the teachers' retirement fund from the general fund over to the education fund. It's about $8 million or so, and that freed up some spending in the general fund that the Senate wanted to have. And there's some dispute over what the impact would be on property taxes. So is this all intertwined?
Yes, it is. And I think actually what John mentioned is a possibility. The trouble is the House wants to find that, you know, not take that money out of the general fund, not leave a hole in the general fund that the Senate's money came out of that goes to those extra spending proposals. But I would think that maybe using the teachers' health care savings for teacher retirement is a possibility.
Let's talk to Annie in Burlington. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
I was wondering if you could speak to whether the school boards are united on this and whether the individual boards were consulted about it.
April, the Vermont School Boards Association supports the governor's plan, right?
Yes. And I don't know whether every individual school board was consulted. I haven't asked that level of detail of the question. I did see a statement today that I think the Montpelier School Board may have some disagreement on this plan. But yes, the School Boards Association has been floating this idea even back to February. They did not talk about a statewide health benefit, but they did talk about this $26 million in savings. So this is something that they had been discussing with legislators for a while now, and it hadn't really gotten much traction. The new piece is this statewide negotiation, and I'm not sure whether there's been a vote for all school board members in the state, but the association certainly supports it.
And Elizabeth, we also got a press release from the Teachers Association urging local school boards to take a stand against the governor's plan. As April mentioned, that happened in Montpelier. So it's a very active issue both for school boards and teachers.
Yep, it is. And it's interesting, actually, there's been a lot of discussion about collective bargaining. And actually, yesterday on the House floor, we saw the sort of echoes of the previous night's debate over this proposal when a separate issue that had to do with states' attorneys' bargaining rights came up. So there certainly it's a very active part of the conversation in many different ways.
Let's turn to Bill, who's calling from Hinesburg. Hey, Bill, what are your thoughts about this?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a former school board member, so I could go on forever. But let me just give you some key points on this. Vermont is the only state in the Northeast where teachers are still allowed to strike. The association is very strong, to their credit, and very united. The issue is, if I'm a school board member in Hinesburg, and I talk to a school board member in South Burlington about a contract, we can be brought up for collusion. It's not a fair playing field. We need a statewide negotiated contract for health care. Because what happens is when we go to negotiations, everything is based upon comps from other districts when we go to arbitration. This is the only way to solve this. And the teachers constantly hold the threat of strike over the heads of the school boards. And that's completely disruptive to our communities. So the school boards have no power, and the association has all the power.
Okay, Bill, we appreciate your thoughts very much. There was a bill, Terry, at one point to ban teacher strikes. Does that get pulled into this discussion?
It has gotten pulled into the discussion, and that came close to passing a few years ago. But I think it poisoned this discussion, or some people found that it did. It's hard enough to get people to buy into a statewide teacher healthcare contract to then also take the right to strike away, that was a double not going to happen. So they took that out of the discussion. But there is a real disagreement, I think, in even the Democrats who sided with the Republicans on this issue are saying we don't think we're eviscerating collective bargaining, whereas the union says, no, that is the definition of eviscerating collective bargaining. You're supposed to negotiate between employer and employee, and the state's not the employer here. But there were 16 Democrats who argued that that's not true. They're still negotiating with somebody.
Today on the program, we're looking at some of the outstanding issues at the State House as lawmakers look for adjournment, they think, sometime tomorrow, although that's up in the air. We're going to take a look at the legalization of marijuana. And that came up in the House this week. The House passed their legalization bill, which is basically a personal possession approach. Individuals could have up to an ounce of marijuana and they could grow several plants. It is not the state regulatory approach taken by the Senate last month that includes retail stores and the taxation of pot. This week, Wells River Representative Chip Conquest said the House plan suits Vermont well.
We carve out a little place where people are free to conduct their own affairs as they see fit, so long as they're not bothering anyone else. Surely that's the Vermont way.
But House Minority Leader Don Turner strongly opposed the legalization of marijuana.
We have enough problems in Vermont with opioid addiction, all kinds of issues that we're dealing with, mental health issues and so on, and now we're going to expand an illegal substance is what we're doing.
Elizabeth, you've been following this issue very closely. The final vote on the bill was 75-71. Was it expected to be that close?
Oh, yes. It was pretty clear that this was going to be a tight vote all along. As a matter of fact, the bill came to the House floor back in March, but was sort of sidetracked to a separate House committee amid uncertainty among leadership whether they had the votes to get it across. There were not a huge number of surprises when it finally did make it to the floor. The debate was brought up some of the key issues that we've heard all along, which is access of young people to marijuana, whether loosening restrictions would make it easier for kids to get a hold of pot, and issues around driving safety, driving impairment, and also some question about the federal level, whether Vermont should be taking this step when it's not really clear whether the Trump administration is going to change its policy towards states that have legal pot.
Do you think there were some people in the House who voted no because they actually support the Senate approach and they don't think that this personal possession idea goes nearly far enough?
Absolutely, there were. There are a lot of people who are for marijuana legalization say that they support it because you could have the tax revenues coming in and helping to support those issues, youth access, driver safety, and also could compete with the black market and try to drive down black market sales. And so there were some people who actually voted for an amendment that would have set up such a regulated system who did not vote for H-170, the legalization.
In April, the Senate bill came up as an amendment in the House debate. It was soundly defeated. It was more than a 2-1 margin. You have the Senate voting for their plan 21-9. Some people have been asking, how is it that the House and the Senate take so different points of view on this issue? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I just think it's a philosophical difference. There are people in the House who just prefer the more libertarian approach. The Senate has always wanted to regulate more and to have more control over the system. I can't speak to individual members and exactly how they fell where they did, but you're right. I mean, the House vote on that tax and regulate amendment was, I think, 99-42 against. So it was kind of the mirror image of what the Senate had wanted to do and their support. We'll see if there'll be somewhere to meet in the middle.
Some of those no votes were procedural. This is not the bill that came out of the House. And there it was on the House floor, and it hadn't been vetted by the House committees. So, I think a pure vote on the issue hasn't been had. And it would be closer, but it wouldn't pass.
Terry, if you look at the states that have legalized marijuana, it's all been done by voter referendum. And Vermont would be the first state in the country to do it through a legislative process. Do you think the disagreements that we're seeing now between the House and the Senate reflect why it's difficult to do it legislatively?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think this is why no one else has done it. And this is why the advocates would like Vermont to be the first and break the ground for other states.
Let's talk to Mark in Windsor. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, I got a couple, words for the House. Jury nullification and voter referendums. They're coming. You're not listening to the voters. 80,000 Vermonters use marijuana on a regular basis, and you people up in Montpelier aren't listening to us. We're getting sick of it. We're going to start acting on our own and through jury nullifications and voter referendums. I know the state doesn't allow it, but we need to change that if the legislature is not going to listen to us.
Well, Mark, that would take a constitutional amendment, so you're probably looking at 8 to 10 years.
Whatever we have to do, we don't want to get into a position like this again. I think it's going to sway a lot of Vermonters to say either they're going to reelect different representatives this fall or the following fall and start having people who are going to listen to us. They're not listening. This has a huge support by Vermonters. Almost probably 60 to 70% of Vermonters agree with this. But our nanny legislatures don't want to do this. We're getting sick of it.
Mark, when you look at that number of 60, 65% of Vermonters supporting the legalization of marijuana, it then breaks down in terms of, do you want something like the House approach, which is what Washington, D.C. did, the personal possession approach, or do you want retail stores and taxation? And so, I mean, that's where the real difference is, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not, because we just want something. We want to move away from being arrested on a daily basis. You know, there's still Vermonters being arrested for possession and other things. And the state isn't listening to us. They keep on going back to this prohibition era, rhetoric that we've heard over and over. Enough Vermonters have enough experience. This has been going on since the 60s in Vermont. We're very well educated on it, and we don't need another state to tell us what to do.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much for your phone call.
Well, I think one of the reasons back to why it's hard to get a referendum or why it is hard to do this legislatively is a referendum is a simple question. Yes or no. Do you want legal or don't you want legal? But what legal is actually hard to figure out. And I think Massachusetts and Maine are finding that now that those places have voted, it's up to the state to figure out how do you implement it. And what Vermont is doing is doing that legislatively. So you sit in a committee room and you decide, well, how much do we tax this? How many lounges can there be? Who decides how that money gets used? All those questions are really complicated.
The other thing I would add is that I think we also are seeing lawmakers sort of change their opinions of this and start to open up. We saw legalization pass the Senate by a greater margin this year than it did last year. And just the fact that it was able to pass the House this year after it was very soundly defeated last year is an indication that some people are changing their minds on this and that I think lawmakers are more open to the idea than they were a couple years ago.
Well, we know that some members of the Senate appear interested in a compromise plan that basically uses the House's personal possession approach and also creates a commission that would look at the best way to implement the state regulatory approach that was taken by the Senate. A report would be presented to lawmakers in January, would be subject to legislative approval. Senate President Tim Ash says the plan has merit.
A commission towards implementing a system that controls and regulates marijuana would be progress this session. We've said that from the beginning, that some progress on extinguishing the black market and moving towards a controlled, regulated system was really our end goal. How we achieve it remains elusive because of the late date of the House action.
But House Judiciary Chairwoman Maxine Grad has a lot of questions about this compromise.
The question with the commission is, what does it do? What are its charges? How much does it cost? Can we do the same work? Can we achieve the same goals differently? I think those are fair and responsible questions to ask.
So, Elizabeth, what do you think? Will this come up in the Senate? If it does pass the Senate, that was a very close vote in the House the other night, 75 to 71. Do you think that this compromise has any legs?
It could. It seems that there is a plan brewing that this could be coming up on the Senate floor within just a few hours this afternoon. That is still very, very late in the legislative session to see anything, especially something that passed by such a narrow margin in the House, make it across the finish line by the end of this session. On the other hand, amazing things do happen at this time of year. But I think that what I would say is that this actually is not that far off from what has happened in states that have legalized by ballot measure, where that sort of base level possession has been legalized and then the implementation of sales has come later, sometimes over the course of years. So I think people might be open to it.
Let's turn to Eli, who is calling from East Burke. Hey, Eli, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. I think it's important to recognize how far and how quickly the legislature as a whole is coming, especially with an administration that's much less favorable than last year's. I wanted to note that I think most advocates really do want to see that compromise go forward and say that the tax and regulate is very complex. We learned that last year during S-241. There are millions and millions of dollars at stake, and there's a lot to be determined. And a lot of committees that a tax and regulate bill would need to go through. However, I think last year folks made it clear that they want to end the threat of criminal penalties, and that if a tax and regulate system is where we're all headed, then we need to remove sort of the threat of those folks who would participate being arrested before that happens. So I think that it's outstanding to see how far the House has come. I think the Senate has every right to be frustrated that it took, you know, an extra 2 months to get it in and that we could have made a lot more progress. But things are progressing quickly, and I think the administration is much more likely to sign off on legalization in 2017 than tax and regulate. So legalization as 170 passed in a commission, I think, is an excellent compromise that moves everybody forward and can be a bipartisan win.
Okay, Eli, thanks for your phone call. Terry, let's talk about Governor Phil Scott in this issue. And let's just say for the moment that there is a compromise creating a commission that would look at the best ways to have the state regulate the sale of marijuana with stores and whatnot. Governor Scott has not been very enthusiastic about this entire issue. What does he do with a bill like that?
I think it will depend on what the charge is, sort of the parameters that Maxine Grad laid out there. It will depend on what the charge of the committee is. Like, if it definitely sets into motion the legalization, that might be a harder sell than terming it, how do we respond to the fact that Massachusetts and maybe Canada are going to have this? And how would we mirror what they have? That might be an easier sell. But he has laid that on the parameter of not until we have roadside tests, and there aren't roadside tests for marijuana. So, he has given himself an out to veto this if that's what he decides he wants to do.
In April, as Terry mentioned, there's legalization in Massachusetts. There's legalization in Maine, Canada. Is this starting to have an impact? Is this a factor on the debate in Vermont that all these states or countries around us are legalizing marijuana?
Definitely it's a factor. It's putting pressure on Vermont. The legislators mentioned legalization in other states during the debate on the floor in the House this week. And also it plays into the debate over just the possession, the House approach, because there's the question of where would people buy marijuana if it's not legal to purchase, but it's legal to possess. So in some ways it kind of it puts pressure on toward a tax and regulate system, but it also allows people to purchase marijuana in a legal way if they're able to possess it in Vermont, but not to buy it in Vermont. So it plays into both versions of the bill.
Let's turn to Jamie, who's calling from Putney. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in Putney, Vermont, and we've been paying really close attention to the full implementation of the Fair and Impartial Policing Law. And I'm really interested in H-308 and where that's going. I hear it's going to the governor, and wanted to hear what your thoughts were on that.
All right. Elizabeth?
Hi, Jamie. So, yep, so the conference committee did finish up work on that bill this week, and that right now is a 13-member panel that will be focused on oversight of racial disparities in the justice system, which is different from the version that passed the House. The House had envisioned this broader scoped panel that would have 15 members and would look at racial disparities across the state and everything from housing to education and beyond. And so the way that they wrapped that up was they have a they have language in there that would direct the administration and some others to start exploring the potential of what it would take to set that commission up. But it is headed to the governor's desk, and my understanding is that he's open to it.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at some of the outstanding issues at the State House. Well, the House this week gave its approval to a scaled-back Ethics Commission bill. House Government Operations Chairwoman Maida Townsend says even a state like Vermont needs to adopt an ethics commission.
This is a very special and different place. We nonetheless do still owe the public assurances of transparency and integrity and propriety in our government.
The bill in the House also calls on the spouses of lawmakers to file financial disclosure forms, and that provision irked Berry City Representative Paul Poirier.
I'm very troubled about the spousal part of the bill. I bring that up because, you know, again, some wives, some spouses, some domestic partners are very private, and they don't want to be involved in the, you know, the openness that we operate under.
So, April, what does this bill do? Is there some urgency to pass it this year?
Well, I think it's ready to pass this year. It's passed both chambers, and it's been discussed now for a couple of years, and there's been a lot of debate on pretty much every provision. So it seems like it is poised to pass. The Senate was going to take up the House amendment to the bill this afternoon, potentially. So we'll have to see how they work out their differences between the two bills. But the differences between the two versions are not huge. And this is a bill that would create an ethics commission to review and refer any complaints about ethical conduct by government officials. But it also would create some disclosures, like you mentioned, financial disclosures for people who are running for office or who are holding high-level state office in the executive branch. It would also require municipalities to create a conflict of interest policy. I don't remember if it was conflict of interest or ethics in general. And it would also put some restrictions around lobbying and going back and forth between lobbying and becoming an elected official. There are some campaign finance restrictions as well. And like you mentioned, the spousal issue came up this week in the House, which was also – that was already part of the Senate bill, but it hadn't really been a problem up until this week when it became this big discussion on the House floor. And ultimately, the House did decide to move forward and – would require spouses to disclose their sources of income as a way of exposing any potential conflicts of interest with government officials.
And April, if I remember correctly, the Senate bill called on all candidates for the legislature and statewide office to release their tax returns.
Yes, that is not in the House bill that I know of, last reading of it. But it would require kind of a broader disclosure of where income is coming from, not the specific amount of income, but where it's coming from.
And Terry, there's also a fair amount of controversy over this housing bond, $35 million housing bond. Why has this become controversial in the final days?
Right. There isn't so much controversy over the $35 million bond or the desire to create more affordable housing. What the controversy is over finding the amount of money that they need to service the bond, which is a couple million bucks, and some of it has been set aside, but they're left with a little over a million, I think, to figure out. And they have played chicken all session long over whose job it is to find that money, because no one's popular when they take the money from somewhere else. And so they want to take turns being unpopular. And now the Senate has come up with a plan to take the money out of the property transfer tax, a piece of money that exists but is targeted for eventual lake cleanup. Now, that's infuriated the environmental community and is a little surprising. I mean, I think the argument from the senators is it's not going to hurt any current cleanup efforts. But what it does signal is that you've already started dipping into a pool of money that is already pathetically low, and they know that they're coming back to a huge decision that they've already put off longer than the environmental community wanted them to on how to fund long-term lake cleanup. So it's just not a good sign that they've already dipped into that.
Let me ask all of you this question. At the very beginning of the session, Governor Phil Scott made it very clear that he would veto any bill that included a tax or fee increase. How much did that really factor into the deliberations over budget or over initiatives that would require a substantial amount of money? Elizabeth, was this a big factor?
You know, I think that it was actually a parameter that leadership in the legislature was not too reluctant to embrace, because there is this great looming question of what's going to happen to federal streams of money into the state. The state gets about a third of its funding from the federal government, and there's a lot of concern that that if a change of policy in D.C. could have pretty significant impacts on the state. And so you heard from a lot of Democratic leaders earlier this year that they were kind of saving their tax capacity for later in the year. That said, we then saw a policy come out of the Senate that did have an impact on property taxes. So I think that perhaps the governor's goalposts were guiding somewhat, but I don't know how significant their impact really was.
Terry, what kind of impact did it have?
Well, I think he had the sort of simple message of no new taxes or fees, and that, you know, if they were inclined maybe to think about small fees here and there, it did sort of tighten the room around them. But they were also willing to embrace this. I think they heard the same message when they went out in the streets last fall to get reelected themselves.
April, what do you think?
I agree with what's been said already. I would just note that there are a couple of initiatives that they just didn't have time to pass all the way this year that would potentially raise taxes, and whether that was a strategic delay of those projects or if it was it just didn't work out this year. Things like paid family leave, which would create a new tax. The water cleanup funds that Terry had just mentioned a little while ago. Some of those that are kind of multi-year discussions potentially that just didn't make it across the finish line this year. But the legislators were not reluctant to even touch those topics. They did pass them at some stage of success there. Like paid family leave made it through the House. And so I think the federal uncertainty was a bigger factor, but we saw kind of a mix of actions by the legislature.
Well, speaking of paid family leave, as you mentioned, April, it passed the House this week. It allows employees to take up to 6 weeks of paid leave time at 80% of their salary level. That's a scaled-back version of the original bill. It's financed by imposing a roughly 0.1% payroll tax on all employees. There is no additional tax for employers. Waterbury Representative Tom Stevens said it was very important to pass this bill.
It provides benefits to everyone, starting from the peace of mind related to knowing that such a benefit exists if needed.
But Northfield Representative Ann Donahue said employee participation in this plan should be voluntary, not mandatory.
It's forcing people to purchase something that they may not want to purchase.
Now, Terry, this bill seemed to have a lot of support at the beginning of the session. I mean, Democratic leaders were touting this as one of their big priorities for the session. But then as the session went on, as we mentioned, the bill got scaled back. The idea of taxing employers was dropped. What happened to this bill?
Well, I don't think they were ever intending to pass it this year. And the Senate, or at least the Senate President Pro Tem, is not all that keen on it in a compare it to raising the minimum wage battle. You know, like he would prefer to raise the minimum wage next year instead of this. But I think there's a constituency in the House that wanted this very badly. I think they also wanted it to help energize their base, which is why it passed this year. But it was, I don't think there was ever a broad coalition to embrace the full plan that started out this year. That was a small core of people.
In April, the governor was never very enthusiastic about this plan either because of the tax increase.
Right. Yes, he didn't want to raise taxes, and he was pretty firm on that all the way through.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Andy in Thedford. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate the program so far. The lively discussion has been awesome. My question now goes back to an issue you guys were talking about a little earlier ago. My question is, if the savings are going to happen from the new health plans anyway, why does this have to be negotiated at the state level? It seems to me like this is the first step towards a statewide district. And once again, thank you guys and have a good day.
All right, Andy, thanks for your phone call. Terry, what's the answer?
Well, I don't know that it has to be negotiated at the state level. That's the governor's stance. I think his argument is that there's a potential for a better deal on the state's side, as we've talked about, that the school boards find themselves in a dilemma when they're facing their kid's third grade teacher and they're saying no to more health care benefits, and that there's a lot of that there would be more continuity. It would be more predictable. How much is it going to cost if there was one negotiation, one 80-20 split, that kind of thing. But it also one of the reasons the governor wants this is to have language that would claw that money back to the state coffers rather than leaving it to be spent on roofs and desks and French teachers and stuff.
So it's difficult to look at the accomplishments of the session since we still have a couple of days to go. But as you look at what's happened during the 2017 session, Elizabeth, are there a couple of things that will stand out as key accomplishments, or is it just too early to tell?
You know, I think as we're leaving, it's clear that there's going to be a lot of these measures are going to be resolved next year. So it's not a huge long list of big accomplishments. There are a lot of sort of smaller judiciary-related criminal justice bills that passed, and I think this session was sort of dominated for me by the theme of everybody kind of getting used to their new positions and trying to settle in and figure out the ropes.
Terry, do you think if the session ends and there is not a veto and there's a balanced budget and no tax increases that both the governor and Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate will say it was a good session?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm not sure we're getting out on Saturday, by the way.
Well, let's talk about that. Why not?
It doesn't look like it. There's no urgency going on. None of the scene looks like I may be wrong. One can always be wrong on these things, but it just doesn't look that way.
Sometimes over there you can sense that adjournment fever is taking over and people are speeding up and saying, if you want to get something done, get it done now. And you don't sense that's happening.
Right.
It'll be fascinating to see how that turns out, and we'll be following many of these issues in the days ahead. Many thanks to our panel, Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and also Terry Hallenbeck of 7 Days. Really appreciate you discussing these issues with us today.
Thank you very
much.
Bob.
Thank you.